remembering folks who served in lots of different ways, those who lost their lives for us, and that we could be together, continue our discussion about storytelling with the two main themes, just thinking about how we're wired to be able to hear stories, how we're wired to be able to be touched by different stories away, and how we might use those stories to help others. And just several folks on our prayer list, I ask her to lead us here in just a minute. Continue to remember the family of Ralph Jones, his wife Faye, and Ben and Thomas, and his passing. The funeral was last Saturday, I reckon. Yeah, and it was. But Ralph is just a good man. I also saw in the obituary listing that another person from ADC, Stuart Fulkerson, passed away.
Carl Kidd.
Well, so remember those families. Gina's got some repair work done on facial reconstruction from an accident she had some time ago. Understand that Mary Ann Doyle's daughter had a port put in to be able to have chemotherapy, and they expect to do that first and maybe some surgery later. My wife's still on schedule to go to Denver July 11th through 19th for a battery of tests on her lung stuff and then some additional treatment and surgery. Mike Cunningham, another connection from out of ADC. Mike was in Arizona for blood transfusions or for chemo for a blood cancer. He finished that, was released to come home, and will be going back for a PET scan, I think, on July 11th. Then trying to see who else is. Teresa, how's your hand healing up? I think it was Nina Taylor was going to have some tests on Monday. If I remember right, I didn't hear anything about the result of those. I don't know if y'all. Nina Taylor this past Monday, I think, was to have two. Yeah. Any others we need to be remembering this morning, Steve? Barry Phelps from out at Summitville. Any others that you know of, mindful of? Just remember, folks traveling as well. If nobody else heard,
pray for these that are mentioned, pray for all of these.
Thank you, Herb. I've used that image before some time ago, but it just catches me about thinking about going into the unknown, traveling into something where you're not sure what's down a set of steps or what's down the road a bit. Think about when our son was working through law school and he spent some time working with International Justice Mission, and he was to travel to India to work in an office in India that dealt with human trafficking and sex trafficking. I'd never been to India. I didn't have any stories I could tell him about what that was going to be like. And we knew the city that he was going to, but IJM, because the International Justice Mission, because they dealt with organized crime, they had one group of folks that worked undercover trying to identify those that were trafficking, those that were kidnapping folks, running brothels, doing illegal activities, human slavery, because they did that and they prosecuted organized crime, and they couldn't give an address for where he was going to be based there. And so he knew where he was going. He was traveling there by himself. We couldn't know where he was supposed to be there. And it was anxious for him and anxious for us, I think, as he traveled to the other side of the world to get there. And I wish I could have had some stories to tell him. Here's what to expect. They tried to prepare him, and it all worked out. It all worked out fine. But sometimes just going into that unknown, if you're going someplace you've never been before, you probably want to hear some stories or be refreshed about it. Herd and Susie have traveled many times to Hawaii and stayed at the same place times. Can you share about your Google Earth experience as you were looking forward to going again? It just, I always got tickled when I heard that story, just that idea of thinking about places that you're going to go or reminders of it. There was a story that I ran across a while back. It was in one of the Charles Swindoll books, and it was about going to an unknown place, and one that touched me. I just wanted to share briefly with you as we're getting started. Swindoll wrote this. Charles Allen tells of a little boy named John Todd, born in 1800 up in Rutland, Vermont. And shortly after his birth, the Todd family moved to the little village of Killingsworth. By the time little John was 6 years old, both of his parents died. Both of his parents passed away. And so Swindoll says, I'll let Dr. Allen tell the rest of this story. The children in the home had to be parceled out among the relatives, and a kind-hearted aunt who lived in North Killingsworth agreed to take John and give him a home. With her, he lived until some 15 years later when he went away to study in the ministry. And when he was in middle life, his aunt fell desperately ill, realized that death was not far off. In great distress, she wrote her nephew a pitiful letter about what would death be like. And here's the letter that John Todd wrote in reply. He writes, "My dear aunt, it's now been 35 years since I, a little boy of six, was left quite alone in the world. You sent me word that you would give me a home and be a kind mother to me. I've never forgotten the day when I made the long journey of 10 miles to your home in North Killingsworth. I can still recall my disappointment when, instead of coming for me yourself, you sent your servant, Caesar, to fetch me. I well remember my tears and my anxiety as, perched high on your horse and clinging tight to Caesar, I made off to my new home. Night fell before we finished the journey, and it grew dark. I became lonely and afraid. Do you think she'll go to bed before I get there? I asked Caesar anxiously. Oh, no, he said reassuringly. She'll stay up for you. When we get out of these here woods, you'll see her candle burning in the window. Presently, we did ride out into the clearing, and there, sure enough, was your candle. I remember you were waiting for me at the door, that you put your arms around me, that you lifted me, a tired and bewildered little boy, down from the horse. You had a big fire burning in the hearth, a hot supper waiting for me on the stove, and after supper you took me to my new room. You heard me say my prayers, and then you sat beside me until I fell asleep. You probably realize while I'm recalling all this to your memory, someday soon, God will send for you to take you to a new home. Don't fear the summons, the strange journey, or the dark messenger of death. God can be trusted to do as much for you as you were kind enough to do for me so many years ago. At the end of the road, you'll find home. And a welcome waiting, love and a welcome waiting, and you'll be safe in God's care. I shall watch for you and pray for you until you're out of sight, and then wait for the day when I shall make the journey myself and find you waiting at the end of the road to greet me. I appreciated that telling and that message. And you think about that correspondence between those two. What was it that John Todd was trying to communicate to his aunt about what was coming? What were the main messages that he was communicating? You don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. What else was there that he was communicating? There's that recognition of what she had done. That was a part of it as well. Other things you see, and she couldn't see what was out there, but that there was something prepared, that it wasn't gonna be something terrible, dismal, awful, unknowable. But it was going to be a rest, a home, a place. Yeah. Anything else you see in that story?
We talk about when Nathan came to David and said, "You're the man." Well, this is, in a good way, what he was saying. You have experienced this. This is a story in your life that proves the right way. And that's what, you know, this was a similar thing. It made her realize from her own experience that this was what was going to happen.
It just sank home that truth so well. And you think about, he could have tried to communicate the same message with the set of facts and the set of bullet points and say, "Don't have to worry, God's there. It'll be okay." You could have gone down that path of just communicating with things that were 100% true and factual, but by telling it in a story and relating it in a story, it hits differently. It really connects differently than just giving those kind of facts. And I think that's part of this wonder of how God has made us and God has wired us, that somehow it connects so well and feels so good. It's when your hand slips into a glove that you've worn many times. Maybe it's an old baseball glove that you were accustomed to and played with and practiced with, and you're just accustomed to it. Or when you return home after a long journey away, or for me growing up, when I'd go back home at times on the holidays and I'd smell my mother's cooking, and you know, a dish that I hadn't had for a year, perhaps since the last Thanksgiving meal or whatever that only my mom made, and you make that strong kind of connection, and somehow giving a story, sharing the truth in a story can go deeper. Why was it that story does connect with us more than facts? Why would it have connected with John's aunt more than just facts? It does. That piece of taking the familiar, the known, the credible, the experienced, something that we've lived through or can relate to, and connecting it to this, in this case, connecting something from the physical domain to the spiritual domain, something known to the unknown. It's bridging that gap. And in this experience, there's that piece of deep love that was... Yeah, it is amazing to think about that. Wonderful to think about that. Just by making those parallels between what we know, what we've experienced, and bridging that gap to what was unknown. So much of Christ's teaching was of that ilk. So much of what he shared was of that ilk, of taking things that were known and relatable and experienced or could be experienced and people connect. Another piece of it is, and I'm not sure how best to say it, but like with Nathan and David's situation, Nathan, in talking to David, didn't start by saying, "I'm going to straighten you out. I'm going to tell you how wrong you were." He didn't start out going down this path. There's an entry into this story that is, that in itself is not threatening. It's not confrontational. It's not one where people will stumble on the entrance and all of a sudden be thinking about, "Well, that's not right," or "I'm going to argue here or argue there," and be thinking about the rebuttal. And going into this story, people are brought along into the thought in a way that does not, it's not harsh, and it's not hurtful or harmful, if you will. It's not, the entry into the story itself is not scary, if you will. That welcoming kind of spirit, that spirit of, "I care about you. I want to share some truth with you," and bringing it in a gentle and loving way is just something I appreciate. But we'll look at Scripture this morning in Luke, the 15th chapter. And if you think about that chapter, if it rings a bell with you, that chapter is the one that has the story of three lost items, three lost things. It's got the lost coin and the lost sheep and the lost son, the prodigal son. So it's when Jesus was teaching, and you think about maybe when a loved one told you something multiple times along the way to try and say, "You really need to do this." I think about Jesus and teaching this, about this idea, the passages in Luke 15. This was something meaningful and important. He didn't just tell one story. He told three different stories. And we'll look at this last one that was there. As Jesus continued, "There's a man that had two sons. The younger one says to his father, 'Give me my share of my of the estate. And so he divided his property among them. And you know, it's a pretty short entrance into this story. Two sons. One says, "Hey, I want my share of all that you've got." And the father complies. What do you think might have been going on in the son's mind, in the son's life, that made him tell his dad this? When you put on the hat of the son, what kind of things might the son have been thinking?
He had a whole bunch that he wanted right now.
Yeah.
His whole life is looking at it. If I had money, I could do it all.
If I just had this, if I just had this money, it'd be better. Yeah.
It just occurred to me that I have a feeling the older brother was a little bit pushy. And, you know, just when he acted later, and bossy, and the younger son, more than responding to his father, might have been responding to the brother, just wanted to get out of there. And as a younger son, I would think it would not have been an even split anyways, because the older son normally got the double portion or whatever, but it's just interesting.
Yeah, may have been his perception of life at home and wanting to get away, that something was going to be better there. Have you ever lived in anticipation of the future, of thinking it's the... Yep. If only I had this, I could be happy. Never.
It was almost like he was afraid the other brother was going to get more than he was.
Maybe he's got a fear that after the father dies, that it'll be different. But you think about what was going on in his life, and then you take off that hat for a minute. Put on, if you were the father, and your son, one of your sons came to you and said, "Give me my share. Either give me what would be due me if you died." What would you be thinking about before you agreed to that request? What would come to your mind wearing the hat of the father? Yeah, he is not grown up enough to handle it, and what's he going to do with it? And I've worked hard, I've saved. What? Anything else that might prompt the father, something prompted the father to give it to him? We don't read that the older son forced, stole, had a gun, whatever. The father made a choice. What motivation could have been there for that? It could be afraid of losing him and the love. It's just interesting to consider what was going on in the father's heart. Tommy?
Great philosopher. Shaquille O'Neal. Shaq.
Yeah.
It makes me think that, you know, the father would have that in the back of his mind.
Yeah.
He doesn't tell us, you know, whatever. But okay, if you think you're rich, let's just see what you do with it. You know, maybe. I don't know. But I thought of that sometimes. It's, no, I'm the one that's rich. Don't forget that. I'm the one that's rich.
Yeah.
You just benefit from being in my household. Sounds a lot like our relationship with the Lord, too.
And that's kind of where this is going. It's that question of, are any of our prayers to God, when we are laying out our wants and our desires, are we like that younger son? Are we saying, "God, please give me this, take care of this, do this for me"? You have seen the little child say, "Daddy, let me drive the car," or "let me use that chainsaw," or whatever it is. And you know, the father's realizing, not right now, not yet. Sometime down the road, or maybe it'd be best if you never tried to use the chainsaw for some along the way. But I think sometimes our prayers to God are of this ilk, where we're asking for things that we think would give us joy and fulfillment and pleasure, and he is like the father in this story of not necessarily, he knows sometimes that our requests aren't what they should be.
The simplicity of the Lord's Prayer, we say, "Thy will be done."
It is.
Not do what I want you to do.
It's a powerful part of that. Just, if we can pray that, if we can pray, "Dear God, please don't just do what I'm asking. Do what you think is right, what you think is best." It's an important piece of this. Well, the younger son got the father gave him what he'd asked for, and he takes off, and he goes and he just wastes everything. Some translations say in riotous living. You can just imagine him burning through it. And after everything was gone and his wallet was empty, he had no money left, and I expect he had far fewer friends at that point than he thought he might have had when he had lots of money. There was a famine, and he thought, "I don't have enough to eat." He hired himself out to somebody to feed pigs, and thought, "Let me just eat what the pigs eat." And for folks of the Jewish faith and Jewish belief, that was a really even more onerous kind of thing. You imagine kind of a graph of his happiness. Sometimes I want to plot things out, and I kind of imagine when he's at home, whatever was going on, he was in a home that was apparently well-to-do. His father had servants. They had plenty to eat, but he's not content. He's below the line, thinking, "It would be better if. I'd be happier if." And then he gets all this money, and I expect all of a sudden his instant happiness graph goes up to some peak where he thinks, "Boy, I have got it made. You know, I can do whatever I want. I'm free." And then all that money gets used up, and there's the famine, and now he's lower than perhaps he ever was before, and struggling with it. It's just striking. Sometimes it's when we hit those real bottoms that reality kind of sinks in, and we see truth for what it is. Luke says the words of Jesus, when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death." Where had he, Luke uses those words, when he came to his senses, where had he been before coming to his senses? How would we describe that place where he had not yet come to his senses? I've been there, I think, at times when maybe I'm confused, deluded, don't understand, not in my right head. You know, I've believed a lie or chased after something that wasn't. But it's kind of interesting to think that he was somewhere where he thought money was going to make him happy. He was somewhere where he thought, leaving the father that loves me and being out on my own is going to be better than being with family. I mean, he was not in a good spot. And a part of the question for us, I think, is how can we tell when we're in that space? How can we tell when we need to come to our senses? Now, growing up, my father would have his way of communicating to me that I needed to come to my senses. But you know, that idea that I'd like, if I am in that state of not being in my senses, of not thinking straight, I'd like to be able to detect it and know it on my own. And I'd like to be able to recognize, you know, I'm doing stuff that's just not, and come to my own. But this idea that we need to continually test ourselves, we need to continually examine our lives in light of Scripture, it's taught throughout the New Testament. It's the idea of we don't need to be comparing ourselves to others and say, how are we doing relative to others? We need to be comparing ourselves to the one who was the perfect example and say, how can I be more like Christ? How can I be more like him? But it's interesting, the son was living this life, pursuing his own, and just wasting so much of what he had been blessed with. And I pray that we can not wander far from the good spot of living a life according to our senses. So the son came to his senses and he said, I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell my dad, I've sinned against you and against heaven. I'm not worthy to be counted as your son. Let me be one of your servants. Just let me be back in the household I abandoned, because I know that was a better place. I know that was it's just a precious idea. In his mind, you think about the reception he was expecting. His dad could have just shut the door in his face. His dad could have said, you made your choice, now you live with it. There are a lot of other receptions that might have come. And when he asked for his inheritance, he was in essence telling his dad, I'd be better if you were dead. I'd be better off if you were dead and I just had my share. He had drawn a pretty harsh line in dealing with his father. And still he thought that his father might receive him. Even though he'd drawn that harsh line, he thought, this is one place I can go. I think there's that hint that was built into him of saying, even though I've messed up big time, there's still love. And I think God has made us that way. That even though we have sinned and fallen short and made mistakes along the way, God has wired us a way to have a hint in our lives. Blaise Pascal talked about a God-shaped void within each of us. This idea that we have a home that we can turn back to. And then that beautiful passage, while he was still afar off, his father saw him, was filled with compassion for him. The father wasn't filled with anger and bitterness and hatred, but the father was filled with compassion, and he ran to him. I just love that idea of the father seeing the son at a distance. He's not waiting for the son to say, I messed up, or please forgive. He's not waiting for any of that. The father runs to him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. It's just such an amazing reception, and I think that's the moment in this parable where there's kind of a plot twist, where it doesn't go as maybe the son expected or others would expect it. The son deserved to be punished. The son deserved to maybe be put on probation for 5 years. You live a certain way, and then maybe we'll let you back in the house. No, the father just runs to him and greets him. And that's the beauty of the image for us. As Jesus is telling, God's love for me and for you, that no matter what we've done, when we turn our hearts back to him, he longs for us to be with him. That is just so comforting. And the son says to Father, I've messed up. I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. The son acknowledges what's happened. I appreciate that the son does that. And then the father tells the servant, we're going to have a celebration. This one he was lost, and now he's found. He was, in essence, dead. He's alive again. And so they begin to celebrate. It's the third in the series in Luke 15 with the coin, with the sheep, with the son. All three of them have this element of celebration, of joy, of reconciliation. That wondrous moment when that which is lost is welcomed back. I like that. I like that idea. And then Jesus doesn't end the parable. He could have ended it right there, but he chooses to add this other little bit. He says the older son was in the field, and he came near the house, and he heard the music and dancing. He said, "What in the world is going on? You know, what is going on here?" And the older brother was told, "Well, you know, your kid brother, the one that got the money and ran off, well, he's back, and there's a party for him." And this older son confronts his dad and says, "What are you thinking about?" And just in essence reminding his dad of all the bad the younger brother did, and that I've been here all this time and you never had a party for me of this. You never did this same, the telling verse, that verse, "But when this son of yours," not this brother of mine, "but when this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you celebrate." You think, what? We ask about what was motivating the father to give the money to the son and to let him go. What was in this older brother's heart that caused him to be so angry and perturbed? What do you think was going on there?
"This party's coming out of my part."
It could be. It could be that what was left was his part. It is a challenge.
And so from a Christian standpoint, I think when we think of the kingdom of heaven, it's for all. We want as many to be there as possible. So it's that loving component that we need to carry out through our daily life.
It kind of goes back to that same parable of the workers, the ones who just did the little bitty amount of work. They're like, great, they don't deserve the same amount of money.
Yeah. There's that temptation for us to take the role of God, in essence, and judge that, you know, that worker didn't deserve as much. I worked harder. And it's God that sees all of what's happened and loves. It's just kind of fascinating to see. And the Father, in closing this parable out, the Father, in essence, said, "You were always with me. I always loved you. I always cared for you. But this one was lost. And now he's found." And we have to recognize that, and we have to celebrate again. I just think it's Jesus. I think Jesus included that portion of the story because I need to hear it. Yeah, because we need to know that other element, that whenever anyone comes back to God, we need to show a fraction of the mercy that God has shown. to him. It is. The succinctness of Scripture is kind of scary at times, but it is. So what do you take as the main message of this parable, the main message of this parable? Is it of God's love and mercy and His forgiveness, a place that's always there for us, an idea that just His nature is there? I think it's so important for every one of us to always know there's hope. No matter what we've done, no matter where we've been, that the Father looks to us to come back to Him. And I am thankful for that. I'm thankful for that idea overall. And I just pray for each of us that the two pieces, one, the piece that we can remember we're never hopeless, that God always loves us, that no matter what, there's a place in the kingdom for us and forgiveness because of what Jesus has done. And that other piece, the prayer, that we can show some fraction of that to people around us and not be like the older brother and think, I'm better than they are. They don't deserve this. But that we're all subject. Well, thank y'all much. We've got folks here for worship, and we'll pick up next week. Thank you.